ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday the 24th of November. I'm Sabra Lane in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. A standoff over the nation's environment laws will shape the final week of the federal parliamentary year. The government says it's prepared to deal with either the Coalition or the Greens to pass the new laws. Both are trying to broker further concessions, with Environment Minister Murray Watt, and they will hold party room meetings today. Political reporter Adam Langenberg.
It's crunch time for Murray Watt. The Environment Minister has just 4 days to negotiate reforms of the nation's environment laws to achieve his promise of getting them through federal parliament this year.
Enough is enough. This week is the week to start making these changes and to pass these reforms.
He's still insisting he can get a deal done with either the Greens or the Coalition, and is willing to make compromises to get them on side, including one to the Greens, making native forest logging proposals comply with proposed new national environmental standards, instead of leaving decisions to the states.
That demonstrates we're prepared to be reasonable here. We're not prepared to give away everything in this bill. We are prepared to make some changes, as long as they deliver to both the environment and to business.
The Greens have welcomed the concession, but Senator Sarah Hanson-Young says it's not enough to clinch her party's support.
We need to make sure that these forests are actually protected, and also that the bill that the government has put forward isn't going to fast-track coal and gas projects, because at the moment that's what will happen.
Senator Hanson-Young says she won't be rushed into striking a deal that falls short of expectations, as some Greens position the talks as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to strengthen environmental protections.
The ball's in the government's court. If they want these laws passed before Christmas, then work with the Greens to protect nature, to protect our climate, and we can get it done.
The Coalition has proposed 7 amendments to the legislation, including lower penalties for breaching the Act and watering down the powers of a new federal environmental protection agency. A government source has told the ABC that Labor is reluctant to weaken the new EPA or ditch climate reporting requirements for major projects. That's a view shared by Graham Samuel, who 5 years ago handed down a review into the decades-old environment laws.
I'd be amazed if the Labor Party caucus was to permit that to occur.
He's also concerned about moves to weaken penalties, which he argues are intended to strike fear in those considering breaking the law.
Really what it says to them is the penalties that might be awarded by a court against you are so severe, just don't take the risk. It's just not worth it.
But he says the biggest priority is getting new laws in place immediately.
Let's just get this passed, please. We've had 5 years of dithering.
The Coalition declined to comment ahead of party room discussions about the laws, but it's expected to use the final week of Parliament to step up its attacks on Energy Minister Chris Bowen, claiming he's too focused on his new role in charge of negotiations for next year's COP climate summit.
This is a win for multilateralism. Is a demonstration of global goodwill.
And not focused enough on lowering Australian energy bills. Those attack lines are expected to be fuelled by Mr. Bowen's comments over the weekend, where he told reporters that his new job won't be an easy one.
Adam Langenberg there. There's a glimmer of hope with a national report on rental affordability revealing some positive signs for those struggling to keep a roof over their heads. After 10 years of declining affordability, many urban areas are seeing a stabilisation. But housing advocates warn large parts of Australia remain unaffordable, even for those with full-time work. Isabel Massali reports.
Louise never thought she'd be living in a converted garage.
My bed and the fridge and the kitchen, bathroom, it's just all in one room. So that's how I'm living at the moment. I don't feel safe.
The 65-year-old teacher grew up in the New South Wales Northern Rivers and returned this year to spend more time with family. She was expecting a tough rental market, but not like this. She doesn't want us to use her last name for fear of it impacting her housing conditions.
I know the government's doing the best it can to alleviate the situation, but I don't think enough is being done. I really don't. I see houses here with 10 and 12 people living in them.
For a decade, Ellen Witter from SGS Economics and Planning has been tracking rental affordability across Australia for an annual report with Peak Body National Shelter.
Rents are expressed as a percentage of household income, and it's typically agreed that once a low to moderate income households start paying 30% of their income or more on rent, they're in a situation of housing stress.
She's seen the situation worsen, first in inner cities, and then spreading out to the suburbs, outer suburbs, and then regional areas. The latest report presents what she hopes are signs of a turnaround.
What we found is that in cities such as Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, and Melbourne, the situation overall has stabilised. Doesn't mean that the situation is good necessarily. It's just that it hasn't gotten worse. But we still see that in a lot of these cities, affordability is at an all-time low. And when I say all-time, across the period, we have our data.
It also shows affordability has improved in Canberra, but it's still declining in regional Australia, especially in WA. And Perth is now the least affordable city in the country to rent. National Shelter Chair John Engler welcomes the green shoots, but stresses large parts of the country remain unaffordable for renters, including full-time workers.
When you can't fill a shift in an aged care facility and therefore be compliant because you can't get staff to go there, that's a productivity issue. It's not just a housing issue.
The body is calling for further efforts to boost housing supply, including build-to-rent schemes and greater coordination between all levels of government.
We would like to see, and have called for a long time, with a number of other organisations, a national housing and homelessness plan that really pulls all this together. I think what we've seen is several governments off on the journey without having possibly planned the itinerary and coordinating with each other.
In a statement, the Special Envoy for Social Housing and Homelessness, Josh Burns, said the report recognises efforts to boost supply across the housing spectrum is making a difference, and said the federal government is working with states and territories to deliver 55,000 social and affordable homes, but acknowledges there's more work to do.
Isabel Massali reporting there. A market failure is happening right now in the National Disability Insurance Scheme, with many not-for-profit providers heading to insolvency. Dr. Martin Laverty, who is a founding member of the NDIS, says it's a train wreck and that he and others who helped design and set up the scheme are horrified. And he blames the agency in charge, the NDIA. Ability Roundtable, an industry group that tracks benchmark prices for services, says a survey of its members found not-for-profit providers recording a fourth consecutive year of losses, with hourly rates paid to them 10% below the actual cost of delivering those services. Dr. Laverty is now the chief executive of Aruma, a registered provider under the scheme. Dr. Martin Laverty, thanks for joining AM.
G'day, Sarah.
We spoke 3 months ago and you warned then of a crisis. What's happening now with not-for-profit?
The Ability Roundtable benchmark that's being published today indicates that registered not-for-profits are now in their fifth year of consecutive losses. In the 4 years to 2024, the average losses were negative 2% each year. It doesn't sound like a big number, does it? But in the fifth year, the 2025 year, those losses have doubled. They've fallen to negative 4. That means over the 5 years that have just concluded, registered not-for-profits have suffered 12% losses. That's unsustainable. And what we're now seeing is a number of not-for-profit organisations have chosen to exit. Others are on the precipice. And the National Disability Insurance Agency has put the government in a really awkward position. The reason for these losses is price. The NDIA is running a flawed pricing system. And the federal government has done the right thing by stepping in to bail out a not-for-profit in South Australia called Bedford. But this is an ambulance at bottom of cliff strategy. The NDIA should be preventing not-for-profits from failing in the first place by correcting the price, stabilising the market, and ensuring that NDIS participants can have a guarantee of service continuity.
You've already just said a number of providers have closed this year, I think four or five recently. How many clients have then been left to scramble for other services? I mean, you helped design the NDIS. You must be scratching your head and thinking, why isn't anyone listening to what I'm saying?
Centrecare Brisbane, Anglicare WA, Momentum Collective, MS Society South Australia, Anecto, Bedford, Sabre, I could go on. It was never meant to be this way. The NDIS was set up for not-for-profits to provide the types of services that NDIS participants need. And what we're seeing in the sector at the moment, that the registered not-for-profits are suffering these extraordinary liquidity crises. At the moment, my organisation only has 3 weeks of operating expenses on hand. It should be, at a safe level, 3 months. The NDIA has known about this for years, and it's put the federal government in that awful position of needing to step into the market. It was never meant to be this way.
With the Bedford bailout in South Australia, is that now a precedent that we're going to be seeing state and federal governments bail out not-for-profits?
It was certainly the right thing for the federal and the South Australian government to do, but it's not a sustainable measure to sustain the sector for the future. We're seeing in the Ability Roundtable benchmark that the average cost of registered provider service delivery is now 10% more than what the price affords.
Most providers are not registered. What is happening there at the moment? And I ask that question knowing that there's been a lot of reporting this year about sexual abuse in the childcare sector. These people who are working in the NDIS who are unregistered, we don't have checks on them. Do we know what's happening?
You'd think with the billions of dollars going into NDIS service delivery that the entire provider market would be registered. That would be a reasonable expectation. Sabra, I think your listeners will be horrified to learn that only 6% of the provider market is today registered. There's 273,000 providers operating in the NDIS. Only 16,000 are registered. 94% are not. And what we're seeing is that the 94% of providers, because they don't have to meet the cost of regulatory compliance, because they don't necessarily have to meet the expectations that registered providers are, the market is growing with unregistered providers. And we're seeing the registered providers meeting compliance costs, exit or fail. The incentives are all the wrong way around. We have to shift the incentives away from unregistered and doubtful providers and ensure that the not-for-profits that are registered and are doing the right thing and in fact are supporting the most complex clients within the scheme, that they're here for the future, because that was what was always intended. But the NDIA price formula is simply not enabling a quality and safe not-for-profit market.
How would you characterise this situation right now?
It's a train wreck. This, for those of us who were involved in setting up the scheme, are horrified with what's happening. And to see the families worried about the homes that their children have been living in for years, the Ability Roundtable benchmark published today tells us that it's supported independent living in particular that has crashed the most in the last financial year. Its profits have fallen by 4% into negative territory. There are 36,000 people living in supported independent living. That means they need 24-hour-a-day support. It's those families, those residents that I'm most concerned for. And the National Disability Insurance Agency has told us it will take 3 years in order for these price arrangements to be changed. We simply don't have 3 years to wait.
Where's the Federal Minister on this?
I could not be more delighted with the urgency and the sincerity with which both Mark Butler and Jenny McAllister have responded to these challenges. Their National Disability Insurance Agency has put them in a really uncomfortable position. But regrettably, urgency now needs to be implemented. There's a very easy way to ensure that we can stabilise not-for-profit providers and ensure that the 94% of unregistered providers in this market are brought to account.
How quickly does this need to happen?
Sabra, it needs to happen yesterday.
Yeah.
But we're willing to work with government to get this done as soon as we can.
Now, this is playing out why the federal and state governments are discussing a new Thriving Kids program, which is supposed to kick in from next July to divert kids with mild and moderate autism to the program rather than the NDIS. And that is contingent on a new hospital funding agreement with the states, which is turned into a good old-fashioned argy-bargy between the states and the federal government. Does that worry you? This never changes.
The NDIS is in the position it's in because the states and territories didn't deliver on their promise 15 years ago to continue to provide supports for mild to moderate people with disabilities outside of the NDIS. If the states had done the right thing back then, we wouldn't be where we are now. But here we are. States, territories, federal government, those of us working in support of people with disability, really don't mind who takes responsibility. Rather, we need the action to ensure financial stability and safety and quality is provided to those for whom the scheme was created.
Shared responsibility is a failure. It never works. Someone's got to be in charge. Isn't that their lesson too from all of this? In future, when we're talking about programs where the states and feds are involved, someone has to be responsible for it.
The Thriving Kids is a solution to a problem that's existed for more than a decade. States and territories simply need to sign up.
Martin Laverty, thank you for joining us.
Sabra, thanks for your interest.
Dr. Laverty is the Chief Executive of the NDIS registered provider, Aruma. The indignity of going to the toilet in a bucket because there's nowhere else to go, that is the reality for many women working in public transport, with a union-led survey finding almost three quarters of women working in the sector suffering health issues related to inadequate toilet facilities like urinary tract and kidney infections. Four in five women say they've resorted to dangerous and undignified coping strategies. National Work reporter Bronwyn Herbert has the story.
Geraldine Graham never had a urinary tract infection until she started working as a bus driver.
For the record, I'm 55 years old, so if I was going to have one, I've now had eight in 3 years, and the doctors said it's brought about by having to hold too long.
She now plans her Brisbane Metro shift around where she can safely or comfortably find a bathroom.
I've had to hold it for over 5 hours. Because the maximum amount of shift you can do is, and that's legally, is a 5 hour shift. So, and I know 5 hours later I'll be back at the depot where I work. There are designated female toilets. Then I will literally, and other women will literally have to hold on for that long.
Cathy Birch has been in the rail industry for 13 years as a train driver in Melbourne, a signaller, and now as a casual track protection coordinator.
One of the things I do when I arrive at site in my car is to plan carefully where I park. So I've got a privacy screen if I use the front ledge of my driver's door to perch on while I have a wee there. So I would then have the driver's door open and the back door open, which creates a screen around me.
She's at times had to resort to extremes.
If I'm caught and it's raining really hard, I'll use a bucket I keep in my car.
These women are some of the more than 800 surveyed as part of a report titled A Bloody Mess, released by the Rail, Bus and Tram Union. Leanne Holmes is the union's national vice president.
Three quarters of the women that we surveyed reported health issues, and out of that, 73% reported UTIs, dehydration and stress because they didn't have access to clean and safe bathrooms. We've actually had members hospitalised because of UTIs, kidney infections and severe stress. That's the level that we're at.
The union is calling for the federal government to boost national safe work standards, including guaranteeing women's only toilet facilities, regardless of shift or location.
Guaranteed access to dedicated women's toilets facilities, proper sanitary disposal units, which are serviced by contractors, not by the workers. Regular cleaning and maintenance of facilities so that they're clean, that they're safe, they're adequately equipped. And we're also talking about freedom for workers to take breaks when needed without being questioned or interrogated when they need to take a bathroom break.
There are already some examples of positive change. In Sydney's West, female bus drivers have been given dedicated toilets for the first time, with the New South Wales government beginning to roll out $18 million in new facilities. Back in Brisbane, workers like Geraldine Graham say bad bathrooms are deterring other women wanting to work in the industry.
We need this fixed. If it wouldn't be good enough for your wife, your mother or your daughter, why is it good enough for women in transport? It's 2025 and it is such an easy fix.
In a statement, the federal government's Transport Minister Catherine King said that all employers have a responsibility to provide adequate, clean and accessible facilities under Safe Work Australia's Code of Practice, and that she's pleased in many instances transport operators are retrofitting facilities drivers need and deserve.
Bronwyn Herbert there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Our peak scientific body has invented a lot, like where would we be without Wi-Fi? But once again, the CSIRO is axing jobs. Today, author, comedian and ambassador for mathematics and science at Sydney Uni, Adam Spencer, on what happens when we slash science funding. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.